Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
You may have seen All Play's Ruins on the tables at places like Gen Con and Origins. It's pretty hard to miss with its transparent cards that actually matter to the theme because you're playing a shedding game where you uncover ancient ruins and find treasure. Upgrades can stack into wild game-altering combinations. You get to claim only two cards during the entire game, so gotta figure out how to construct the perfect combo. This small box game, designed by John DeClaire, is for 2 to 5 players playing in about 40 minutes for ages 13 and up, and is now available on allplay.com, along with all the really cool upgraded tokens, which I know a lot of people enjoy. Check it out! Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 122, Licensed to Krill. Today we're joined by Matthew Kambick, the owner and designer at Macaw Games. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to have you on, especially because I'm not sure if I've had an episode where there's a plushy component of a game, but I guess before we jump in to our spotlight, can we talk about what got you into designing games?
Sure. So, been playing games since I was very young. In fact, my parents taught me bridge when I was probably only 5 years old. Later, with my brother, we both knew bridge. We would play my parents. There's a formality to bridge, certain rules to follow, unwritten rules and procedures, and we would just shoot, you know, wild. We would just go crazy, and to the chagrin of my parents, because sometimes we would beat them because, you know, they're following the formal rules. But that being said, definitely been playing board games since I was very young. And then more recently, about 5 years ago, before COVID, I one day got the idea. I do engineering in my day job. That's what I went to school for. I like board games. Why have I never thought to combine the two and do a design of my own? So once the idea hit, then it was something I couldn't get out of my mind and spent a lot of time on since.
So is that kind of like a side hustle at this point for you?
Oh yeah, 100% side hustle. My day job keeps me very busy and pays the bills more than adequately, but making the board games has its own reward and its own challenges. It's a long pursuit to get a game to market, as you know, but it's also very rewarding, especially at the end. During the middle, there's times when you're beating your head against the laptop going, I hate this, why am I doing this? But then you just got to think of the long term.
Oh yeah, I can 100% relate to that. So then for Licensed to Krill, what made you inspired to design that game in particular?
Of course, yeah, and sometimes I even get the question, are you a biologist or a marine biologist? Because there's a lot of fun facts in the game and there's a lot of theme in the game based off of the real life things that are centered around krill. And the answer to that is no, I'm not I don't have any formal education in marine biology, but right before COVID, got the idea from my brother. He all of a sudden decided he was going to make a game, and that sparked, oh, maybe I should make my own game. And as you know, two people can have nearly the same seed idea and end up with totally different games. It's part of the design process. But my first original idea was a game for more of a sandbox environment for electing a president. So there's no politics. It's just somehow we're a country and we need a leader, and there's a mechanical process to that. And I thought the mechanics of that are interesting. During design of that, I was trying to get a lot of outside perspectives and interviews and, you know, blogs and everything I could, you know, Jamie Stigmeier's blog and listening to YouTube videos and all these great resources. And I found one on the Board Game Design Lab of a guy who was going to do a 1-hour class where you got better at designing board games. And I thought, I'm not above that. Let me try it out. So joined it, and during one of the exercises, we spun a wheel of mechanics, and we were forced on the spot to design a board game as a thought experiment based on two constraints, which with constraints comes creativity. And I wrote down in my logbook, Licensed to Krill was the name and the pun, and I came up with some rough mechanics. A couple months later, I thought, I wonder if I could actually turn that into an actual game. Like, what would Licensed to Krill be? So I really was pun down. I don't necessarily recommend this design procedure, but started with the pun, and I said the pun must have krill in it. What is a krill? Well, they're eaten by whales, so there must be a whale in it. What would the whale do? And then, you know, kind of one thing evolved into the next, and that became a fun part of the design process for me, which was, I need a new card in the game. There's a mechanic I have in mind, but what would be the pun? So I started with the pun for the card even, so maybe a kriller whale. What would a kriller whale, how are they adjacent to the krill? So the kriller whales like to hunt some of the prey that eats the krill. So it's really the, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of a situation. So then I thought krill or whale must be somehow the buddy to the krill in an indirect way. And then what would be the mechanic and how would that interact and make the players play the game in a new interesting way when this card comes up? And then what would be the graphic on the card? And then I worked with my artist. So it was a real fun process that way.
I love Pun First. In my first season, I had Abandon All Artichokes, that game by Emma Larkins. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hers, same exact thing. It was like a Twitter thread of a bunch of crazy names, and everyone's like, that one. What would that look like? And it's like, oh, okay. And then kind of a reverse deck builder, a deck wrecker,
yep.
is how she described it. And so I think going by the name is not a bad idea, especially when you're building a lighter game, such as yours, especially with an interesting component.
Nice. I also have that game. It's a good one as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how to play.
Yeah, sure. So quick overview of the game is we're trying to get the most points, as with most games out there. The whale is the box. He's a plushie. He's actually a central component in the game. You can't actually play the game quite as efficiently or effectively without him. And therefore, the whale, in addition to being the actual carry case that it comes in, is the main threat. So on your turn, you do simply three things. There's a market, kind of a tableau of choices. You draft a card out of the market. It's an open market, so there's no hands. Everything's on the table. You put it into your player area, and then you do what the card says, simple actions or set collecting. The second thing, based on the card you drafted, the whale now moves to a certain location or does a thing, and you know this because the card you're drafting is coupled or paired with that secondary action. And then the last thing you do is see if Mr. Spouticus, that's the name we came up with on the Facebook group, if he's hungry, if he eats the card of the target player. So you can target anyone you want, or you may prioritize the set collecting, which may inadvertently target yourself. And then at the end of the turn, all your plans you can only predict so far, and then it turns out Spouticus is sleeping and nothing happens to the target player, and then play proceeds on clockwise. So turns are quick, goes around the table. Sometimes you collect a bunch of cards, sometimes you lose a bunch of cards. Definitely the belly of the whale is pretty full near the end of the game. And then when the dust settles, there's a kind of a timer deck, and when the timer deck runs to the very bottom, one of the bottom five cards ends the game, and then you count your points and see who's won. So that's the quick overview.
I love that you got to name the plushie in your Kickstarter. Did you do any other fun things when you were putting the Kickstarter together?
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of engagement on the comments. In fact, that was one of the stretch goals. A buddy of mine who had run a Kickstarter, he had in mind to really farm the comments to kind of build community. When people are talking, they get to know of other interests or other interesting things, or maybe the game itself becomes better because people make great suggestions. So I really wanted to foster that. So one of the stretch goals was the game gets better for everyone if we hit a certain number of comments, somewhat arbitrary number, but you got to pick something somewhere. And a lot of people in the comments to help get to that number were giving great puns, they were giving great jokes, they were talking about nautical-related stuff, so it was real fun. I did the same thing in my second Kickstarter because I liked it so much.
Oh, I love when someone can be able to foster community through a Kickstarter, like a crowdfunding campaign, especially because the argument to so many of them is they're just a marketing machine, but for the little guy, it's the only way you're making your game.
Yeah, for sure.
So what made you decide to self-publish?
So I wanted originally to have someone sign the game, and as you know, that's a process.
It's a beast.
It is, and I like having gone through a bit of the process myself. I think a great analogy is getting married. So, you know, there's only the one person for you. At least that's how I would look at it. And you try on a lot of potential suitors, and you meet a lot of people, and you learn, you become a better person, but ultimately you're looking for the one. I would translate that into when you're pitching a game, there's a lot of great games out there and not every game is for everyone. That publisher is really trying to think about what's marketable for them and what they can bring the market to align with their audience and their values. And it's a process when you give them the sell sheet or you pitch it or you show them the game. So I've gone through all that. Unfortunately, I didn't find any nibbles. I didn't find a publisher to say, yeah, that's definitely the one for me. We're going with that. But I got close on a couple of them. Hasbro and Exploding Kittens were just two of the ones that took a deeper look. And it was, you know, flattering that they put it in front of their focus groups, but it wasn't the game for them. And then that's fine. But I thought this is a game that I've spent too much time on and have too much fun actively. I still play it with my family, and even at the Origins convention, I think I played it a good 30 times with a bunch of groups and still have fun with it. This game has to exist. This game has to be out there. So let me look into that self-publishing route a little bit more. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized this is going to suck and it's going to be a lot of work. But I went in with my sleeves rolled up, ready to see it to the end.
So I started my career actually trying to run a Kickstarter, and I learned a lot of lessons, such as I should not have done that. But I totally understand that, like, the fight to try to find the one, and then maybe you get so close. And that's very validating that two huge companies got it to the point of even testing with a focus group, because that means you have something. So that, I'm sure, kind of made you be like, you know what, I'm going to take a chance on this. So then tell me about the name. Macaw Games, what does that mean? What does that stand for?
So a client from my day job, the first two letters of his first name and the first two letters of his last name smashed together made the name of his company. And I thought, that sounds kind of fun. And it worked for him. So I thought, well, I wonder if I could do the same thing. So, of course, my first name is Matthew, so M-A. And the last name is Kambek, K-A. And I said, well, what would M-A-K-A be? And there's lots of ways to pronounce it. Some people would say Maca Games. Some people would say, I've heard it like a parrot, macaw. There's no wrong way to say it. I've even had some people say, you make a games, and I do make a games, so it could be pronounced that way as well, I suppose. I needed a legal name to come up with, of course, and that's what I settled on.
And then you actually have a nautical theme to the logo. Was that because you felt like you were going to exclusively be making nautical themed games in the future, or like what was the idea behind that?
Yeah. The game is centered around krill, and krill are very similar to shrimp, and most people are more familiar with shrimp than they are krill. And I thought this will be my first game, and I thought I'll build some of the identity around it. I didn't set out to be exclusively nautical. In fact, the second game, I was thinking I had an idea for a game, and it was about pushing buttons. And then I thought, I have a card and it should blow up, so let me put a bomb on it. Everyone knows what a bomb is. It's intuitive. I was making the second one, not pun first. I tried it mechanics first. So I thought, what would be the most intuitive icon or theme? This is a shield, so it's going to literally be a shield because it, you know, protects you from the bomb. And this stops the bomb, so it's a diffuse. But after playing it for a while, I was realizing it's a little vanilla. It's a little boring. Everyone has heard of bombs and games with bombs and stuff. What's marketable is to have a built-in audience, and what's marketable is to have something unique and fun and novel. So I worked quite a lot on retheming it, and I looked at everything. I looked at ants and seasons, everything I could think of that really tied in well with the mechanics, and I landed on octopuses because the subtlety and the bluffing that the second game has really works well with that theme. And I'm like, oh, nuts. Now that I've landed on octopuses, now I'm forever going to be known as the nautical guy, right? So I've kind of pigeonholed myself in, which is fine. I like it. And the more I researched krill, the more I researched other things about other animals and even octopuses. And now that I'm researching and have done research on an octopus game, it's led me to nudibranchs, like sea slugs, and other really weird and interesting creatures. So I've already got a couple ideas of, if I were to stay in the nautical vein, what the next game might even be. But it's a great vein. There's an endless depths of themes and interesting creatures to base things off of there.
I feel like certain game companies have identities that are like so obvious, and you're like, oh, that's such a cool take. So with all that research of the fun nautical nonsense, which you should totally make a game with that name, how did you end up linking some of what you were learning into the mechanics of the game as you were playtesting?
Yeah, that for me is, if I were to give a focus of my company, is the theme has to be very well married into the game. I know that's somewhat cliche in the industry, but I'll give you some examples. So the more the theme is integrated, the more I find intuitive the players find things, and they tend to appreciate them as well, even if not so verbally. There's a baleen whale, and it eats the krill, and it spits out the water. It separates the food from the water, and that's where the netting, the baleen of the whale, separates the two. And when you zipper the whale plushie, the zipper is literally a baleen. If you were to fill it with water and krill, the water would come out. I don't recommend this, but the water would come out, and the animal would stay in. Also, mechanically, the ocean market is like an underwater you know, smorgasbord or a river or choice of menu of options. And as with any spot in the ocean, things come and go, as with cards in the market. So I thought a market really accurately represented the flavor of choices and how they came and went. And even things you do on your turn, the individual cards, like there's one card that's the Krillnado, which is a card to kind of mix up everyone's hands. So, and with that one, you know, everyone would pass a card to the left or to the right. And then I had to find a fact about the underwater life that, you know, would substantiate that. So I really liked tying all three together, because then when you learn the game, but then later read the fun fact on the bottom of the card, then you're like, oh, interesting. So this card is called Poop Loop, and it's maybe funny, and it's one of the more, you know, oh, look at this card, you know, it says Poop Loop. But it's the interesting scientific part that the iron is spread through the ocean through the whales, because it's bioaccumulated in the krill that eat the phytoplankton, and then the whale comes and eats all the krill, and tons of krill a day. The iron is stuck in the ocean in these whales, and then whales do what whales do when they have to relieve themselves, and now the iron is spread back, and then all the little creatures can eat it again. So it's a necessary part of the ecosystem. The more I researched it, the more interesting it became.
That almost sounds like that song where it's like, and the this ate the that, and that ate the that. I don't remember 100% how it goes, but I feel like it was an old lady who swallowed a fly. That's where it started out. Yeah, the rest of the lyrics do not remember. It's been a while since I've been a child. As far as like your playtesting went, did you play with friends at conventions? How were you testing these mechanics?
I wanted to make sure not to design a game that was too narrowly tested. If you test just with your folks at church and your family and your friends, a lot of them are too supportive to be critical. They'll say, you know, the game was great, I had fun, I'm there for you, I want to encourage you, which is all great to hear, but it's not great for the game, and it doesn't help to generally develop or push the game forward. And you need people that are critical, but constructively, and you also need people that are good at kind of self-evaluating their feelings as they play and being able to materialize those into words and meaningful thoughts. There might be points in the game where you felt frustrated. Those are the kinds of things that you need your playtesters, I find, to verbalize at the end. And then once they verbalize their frustrations, don't always take their words at face value. They are important words, but what is more important is the feeling behind the words. Sometimes their suggestions are great, and sometimes their suggestions are to design a game that they would like and not necessarily the game that you need to design for what your goals are. And therefore, the frustrations are valid, and you may need to address those frustrations, but you also may need to evaluate that this is a heavy Euro gamer who's, you know, used to playing a 2.5-hour game, and now he's playing a 20 to 25-minute game, and it's a different feel, and he's not necessarily the right market audience, but he is going to be able to tell you things like, if I play this card, it's always the best choice. Well, you're probably right, and maybe that card needs rebalancing, so that's not as interesting as always having interesting choices, but shouldn't be one clear path. So the more specifically answer your question, there were online groups that I regularly met once a week, and we would swap playtests with each other. Those were real helpful, and those were, you know, designer-centric people. There was a lot of just average gamers at like conventions and other meetups where people met with the goal to play games, and that's another more generalized audience, but also a lot of the market that I would focus on would be there. But then I also wanted to focus on people like my grandmother, or my mother, I should say more specifically, my kid's grandmother. I refer to her sometimes as my grandmother, but she's really my mother. She's really great because she's not a gamer, and don't get me wrong, love her to death, but anything over sequence would be something that she would really have to invest time. And I'm like, you know, it's not that difficult. Let's just spend a couple minutes learning it, and I know you'll get it. But she's a great test market for me as well, because if it's not confusing for her, then I already have confidence that I've achieved a certain level of lean in versus a gamer, when I can say terms like tableau and they'll be like, yep, of course. And you know, someone else would be like, what is that word? I don't know what that means. And so that a wide array that I try to get of different opinions and market focuses, to really try to make sure that there's not going to be a game where there's, you know, a one scenario found that's always the optimal path. I can't find every scenario, but I can at least do 350 playtests to kind of find the majority of the stuff that'll come up, the edge cases, to make sure to put in the rulebook and stuff.
Did you have, when you wrote the rulebook out, a like Q&A section for those edge cases? Or did you put that on a website, or did you incorporate that into the main rules?
when I found edge cases, I tried to eliminate them by redesigning the game as much as I could without making major changes. So if there's a thing that says, you know, whenever this card comes up and then I find too much text is required to describe it, that's a hint that I probably need to get rid of it. With lighter games, that's something you have to probably adhere to a little more strictly. Heavier games, that's fine. And that's probably, in fact, the charm of a heavier game is those weird edge cases, because that creates very interesting scenarios. But in a lighter game, you don't want anything to be hard. You don't want anything to be confusing. And you don't want anything to be like, oh, we got to pull that rule book back out. But there was a couple cards that I was able to explain with two sentences or two lines of text was what I was holding myself to. And I thought, these are the most commonly asked playtester questions, and that while I could remove the card from the game or redesign again, it created interesting scenarios, and I really liked the card. So I thought, yeah, I'll put just a very brief in the back of the rule book saying, you know, if this does actually happen, I already know the answer because I've been asked it several times. So I included a little, like you said, Q&A in the back, and it was only like five or eight, I think it was about eight things that may get asked, and you know, there'd be some games where no one would ask, but there'd be some games where like, hey, what happens if we play this in this order? And then you just, it's right there, easy to get to on the back page. But you can't prepare for everything. As with software development, there are always bugs. As new things, once the game is released and, you know, now everything is minted and you can't change it and revise it unless you do a second printing. I've been going to Board Game Geek and I have the official stub under the frequently asked questions on the forums section of that, where you find the game on Board Game Geek is kind of an official reference of here's it, you know, the addendum to the rule book, things that have come up that didn't come up in the 350 playtest, but also things maybe that I've, you know, had more time to think about it and could probably phrase slightly better.
I think that's great when someone, after the game's printed, keeps a list of these, like, Q&A questions, just because, like, they're going to come up. You can't plan for everything. Doesn't matter how much you playtest. So when you were pitching the game and you had your little plushy whale, did you tell people, like, this needs to be in the game? Or was it like, hey, if you sign it, it cannot be in it. It could be a token. What was your thought when pitching?
Well, I know with most publishers, they won't sign a game unless they have liberty to change most anything about it. There could be understandings, you know, okay, well, this one thing will pass or whatever. But so I went into it with that in mind, that anything in the game might be subject to change, and I can't be married to something too much. So I was flexible in that regard. But the whale is, I think, part of what the game is designed around and would be difficult to realize without. So I had already tried thinking ahead of the questions, and could a box become the whale? It's literally a box like any other piece of cardboard, but has a little slit, and then, you know, it has graphics and somehow, or maybe you turn the box inside out and now that's the whale. And I had alternatives in case that situation came up where I would be like, actually, I've thought about that and here are some ideas. And that is usually all you need to spark their train, because they may take the idea, or they may just run with it and they say, okay, I see he's flexible and we'll figure this out later. So that's how I approached it.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, and definitely something that anyone who's a designer listening to this episode, keep that in mind. So you decide to print it yourself. You wanted the plushy whale, clearly, because it is in the game. How did you go about manufacturing that?
So with my day job, you always get three quotes minimum. So I thought I gotta find some manufacturers. And first question is, and more meaningful today, do I go domestic? Do I go abroad? And most people I talked with are like, well, you know, the highest quality is generally considered China, and the best price is also generally considered China. And I said, well, that's where I'm going to see where most of my quotes come from. And I got a bunch of quotes, and for sure they were the cheapest by far. And this is pre-tariffs. And then I prioritized what was most meaningful for me in a relationship with a manufacturer, and that was the relationship with the sales agent. Because if I get something wrong my first time around because of a miscommunication, because of a language barrier, and the size of the card is a millimeter or two wide, and now it doesn't fit in the box, or the quantity of cards throws me into a new weight category, and now my shipping goes up $2 a unit because I hadn't considered that. Like, those are things that I knew I didn't know, but I knew if I had a good relationship with the sales agent that they would help me through. So price was not my primary concern the first time around. I really wanted someone that was going to, you know, not be frustrated by my newbie questions and also be there to say, hey, you haven't asked me about this, but did you know that a plush toy actually needs to be registered in 3 states in the United States? Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Massachusetts. They have special plushie laws on the books, and you know, if you're in any other state in the U.S., you wouldn't have to worry about that potentially, unless you wanted to sell in those states. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that, actually. Thanks for bringing that to my attention. And it just so happened that my home state of Pennsylvania is the one of those 3, and it also just so happens that Pennsylvania is the most strict, and therefore, if you can get it done in Pennsylvania, the others are reciprocal, and you don't have to worry about them. So pretty much everyone registers in Pennsylvania, and then they're done, and the 3 states that care are happy, and then the other states that don't care, you've got the regulations in place, and they're, you know, dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's.
That's super nice that you were able to find that. Who did you end up going with as far as the manufacturer?
I went with Longpack and was very happy with the level of attention that they gave me. Like I said, my sales rep was very responsive and answered all my questions. They were also, I'll say, very competitive on price. So even though I wasn't optimizing for price, it just happened that the one that gave me the best relationship was also one of the best quotes as well. Now, that's at the 2,000 quantity, of course. Originally, I was asking for quotes with 500, and it's the MOQ minimum of most, and most even don't even go that low. But the more I started looking at it, the more I said, you know what, if I spend literally 15% more, I can get double the amount of volume of the product. And it's like, why wouldn't you spend 15% more to get twice as much of everything? Now, your shipping goes up, of course, and your logistics and two pallets instead of one, and you get hit with the storage fee every month. Yeah, so there's costs, but for 15% more and I can get double, and then wait a second, if I could go double again, you know, so that's where I landed on 2,000. It seems for me to be the sweet spot where you're not invested so much that you're going to have them for the next 20 years in case the game doesn't sell well, but also your cost is so much cheaper than it would be at 1,000 or 500. It's almost not even worth considering unless you're not up for the long-term game of, you know, selling your game and promoting it.
Which I guess that's a fair point. As a designer self-publishing, what is your goal?
I've been asked that a lot. Like, is this going to become my full-time gig? Am I going to quit my day job? The quick answer is definitely not. I'm going to maintain my current employment for a very long time. But this is something that, you know what, for a while there, I like to play things like video games and watch movies, and I found myself doing less of that and more of this, but this, at the end of the day, I can look back and say I've accomplished something, whereas those other things, they're fun in the moment, but then I look back and I can say, well, I lost a lot of games of League of Legends. I got up to silver, but it's not impressive. I've spent a lot of time trying to go up a ladder, and, you know, I clearly am not the best at those things, but this is something that, even though I'm not the best at it, it gives me a lot of enjoyment, and there's a certain satisfaction to walking into a store and seeing your game on the shelf that is hard to put into words.
Oh, yeah, totally. And then how long do you think it took from that initial idea of the pun to it actually being out to the backers so they could play it?
Oh, that definitely was 2.5 years in the making, and then the Kickstarter, and then 6 months to 8 months later, it was in their hands. So it was at least a 3-year endeavor to say, I've got this idea, and how do I go about it? And a lot of the delay was in researching how to do things properly. I'm a big researcher. I like to dig into a lot of as much as I can before I just jump into something. But then I got to the point where I realized I could research this for the next 10 years. I've got enough knowledge that I can be dangerous, and I'll figure out the rest as I go. And then the actual manufacturing only takes about 3 months, but you got to plan it with them. And then the actual fulfillment only takes about 3 months. But then there's other things that slow you down, like you decided to allow people on Kickstarter to submit images, and they're going to be in the game as new cards. And then those people don't get back to you after the Kickstarter ends. And then they finally get back to you, and you got to send it over to the artist, and then they don't get back to you. And there's things to consider that really slow the process down. But mostly it was an eight month from the Kickstarter day one to when they got it into their hands, and everything else was, you know, leading up to that, about 2.5 years of making the game, testing the game, researching, refining, learning the process. All that said, the second time around, I had the benefit of having done it once prior, so the game idea came to me rather quick. It wasn't a game I had in the hopper. I have some games in the hopper, but I haven't brought them to market yet. This one, like 3 months after the Kickstarter, I'm like, crap, I have an idea. I think it could be a cool game. And I say crap because I'm like, now maybe this will be my next game. Like, I got these other cool games. I want to bring them, you know, and he's jumping the queue. You know, what is this game? And
it's so funny, jumping the queue in your own game.
Line. Yeah. And my wife, you know, she's a real supportive, and it's funny. She'd be like, oh no, you didn't have another game idea, did you? I'm like, yes, you know, they never stop as a designer. It's great.
It's so good. And what game was that one?
The one that jumped the queue was the Ink Tensions game that just was on Kickstarter. That's the one that started as Buttons, and then I rethemed the Octopuses. That one I'm in the process of working on getting manufactured and delivered now that the Kickstarter is over.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, I've seen pictures of it, and I saw it briefly at Unpub walking by, but it looks cool from the presentation. As far as like the whole process went between the designing and also the manufacturing, do you have like a favorite experience and a least favorite experience?
I can definitely tell you least favorite off the top, right forefront, without thinking about it, is shipping and logistics.
Ah, well, yeah, that'll do it.
So it's not just things like COVID. I was fortunate not to be in the pipeline of shipping when that hit, and hearing the horror stories of shipping containers going 8 times more than they would normally be, and delays, and then the issues with the Suez Canal and such. And it's not just things like tariffs and duties and de minimis being absolved and all of these unforeseen things and the unpredictable situation that we might find ourselves in today about you can only plan so much. It could change in August. It could change in September. All that aside, the most annoying part for me was trying to coordinate a manufacturer with a third-party Chinese company for shipping, and then the warehouse, and then realizing that there might be a rebate discount that the manufacturer is anticipating getting from the Chinese government because it's an export. But now that I'm using this warehouse in China on its way out, it's being exported, but it's on its way out. It rests in this warehouse. Now it doesn't count for that rebate. And then the Chinese manufacturer says, now what do we do? How do we figure this out? Another frustrating part is I don't speak Chinese, so you can only get so far. And then you basically have the two companies call each other, and then they, quote, speak in Chinese to each other. And that's when the real business happens. So you can only line things up to a degree, and then it's out of your hands at that point. And I don't know, I found the whole process frustrating. So I'd say shipping logistics is my least favorite part. I would love for that just to go away and pay a company and say, here, handle it. Let me know what to pay you at the end of the month and make sure it gets into backers' hands. The most fun part would just getting the ideas when they're new designs and they're fresh and you're like, this sounds like a cool idea, and you start moving pieces around and you start sketching on cards, and those are probably the most fun games that most people will never play. The most fun games are the games you mentioned, like at Unpub, and even before Unpub, those are the absolute most fun for me, are the games that are so broken, they're so unbalanced, but they're so fun. They create such memorable moments. You remember that game that you had back then, and remember how you blew up all my cards? And you know, you don't tend to get those when it's a polished game and things are balanced and decisions are equally of weight and intensity. That makes the game marketable, but that doesn't necessarily make those unbalanced, fun, memorable moments. Some games can capture that, but generally speaking, the real, raw, unpublished playtesting game is for me the most fun.
I'd get a little too excited about a new idea. Sometimes to the point of also jumping the queue, it's a problem I'm attempting to work on, but yeah, I can relate. It's kind of fun. It's like a little adrenaline rush. Do you have like a really large takeaway from the experience, whether it's from starting your own company or the design itself?
Yeah, so the legal side of things sucks, right? You got to do more taxes. You got to make sure plushy registration is done. And now it's a yearly thing. It's a monkey on my back. Once a year, I have to remember to renew it. And this year, as an example, just to tell you for 1 minute my experience with the state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, they have a website that they launched so you could do your renew your registration online. You don't have to send us anything anymore like the old days, right? We're in the 21st century now. Unfortunately, the budget was cut right after it got approved, and there's like no programmers working on staff anymore. So their website is like of their own admission, horrible and not working great. And I couldn't get past the login. And then I called in and they said, actually, it's worse. We just enacted some new legislation that requires LLCs to do more paperwork in Pennsylvania. And now our queue times are longer to get to an agent. So half hour later, I spoke with someone. They did a password reset, which didn't help. And a half hour later, I got a new agent. And they said, it's not your issue. You've entered everything right. It's on us. I'm like, oh, okay, we'll fix it. They're like, that's another department. So then I had to hang up that call and speak with the plushy stuffed toy registration. And they're nice people, but you know, they're like, okay, you're gonna have to send an email, and then you're gonna have to wait for the guy to email you back. And I'm like, this is coming due. And like, I've spent hours and hours now. So got it in, all said and done. But the takeaways are, there's a lot to make Uncle Sam happy, you know, and to do everything legally on board. But it's a lot of effort. So if you can find someone that loves business and partner with them, that sounds, for me at least right now, very attractive. Be like, you know what, you handle the business side, I'll handle the creative side. Definitely, if you can sell your designs, license them to companies, that's probably the pie in the sky. Yeah, there's a lot of effort in getting someone to sign one, but once you get that ball rolling and you got like one or two designs signed, things become a lot easier and more difficult. But at least you're on short lists of like, hey, you got any more games? I signed your last one. Let me check. And then you can get playtests that you never would, and you get insider. And then one guy was like, you know what? I'm going to share this with my other buddy who's at this other publishing company. And so to get to that point is a lot of work, but that's when you can really focus on what you find the most fun. And so I guess the takeaway is focus on what's fun if you can. Be like that guy from Reader's Digest that found the greatest job in the world. And you're like, what's the, you know, it's the little tease on the cover. What's the greatest job in the world? So you open it up and you read. He did find the greatest job in the world. It was handing out tickets at a toll booth. And you're like, how mundane. Why is that the greatest job in the world? Because his passion was tap dancing. And he could tap dance in between handing out the tickets. So he found someone to pay him to do what he loves. So that's the takeaway. Find someone that can reward you for doing what you love. So if you love designing games, there's a lot of effort. But if you can get to the point where someone would pay you for that, you know, and then you can go design another one. If you enjoy seeing it on the shelf because you self-published it, you know, there's a lot of work there and there's a lot of reward there. So see if you can find someone that rewards you for the parts that you find the most fun.
For me, did not want to self-publish because I realized very quickly I didn't care about a lot of those extra bits and agreed that I would not do it alone. So Godspeed, I would also want a business partner. I know you kind of mentioned very briefly that you just had a project on Kickstarter. Do you have any other games people should be looking out for, or can anyone like late back that one?
Yeah, so the late pledge is still available on that one. And once the pledge manager opens, that's when it'll have to close. So there's probably another month that it'll be open, 3 weeks to a month, and then that will close. And then I'll have to, you know, I can't take orders forever. I have to eventually get numbers and send them to get quantities produced. So that one's still on Kickstarter. Ink Tensions is the name. Another game that my wife keeps bugging me, and she's like, when can I play this game? And so she's played the prototype, but like, when can I have a production copy? It's a tower defense game, and there's a few good tower defense games, like the Spire game and such, that are out there. But I wanted a family weight game, and then you immediately think of, well, what about that Castle Panic? That's great, too. But that one, it's a little light for me. I'm looking for something in between Castle Panic and Spire that's gateway-friendly. So I came up with one where there's a twist on the genre, which is you're not just incentivized to build on your own territory to mind your own monsters coming. You are incentivized to build on others to help them. But the game is, if you can kill the monster that's coming, you get full credit. So you're like, I'm going to help you out involuntarily. They don't have any choice in it. And it'll help make your path stronger, but I'm going to hope that by the time the baddie gets to this point that, you know, his last hit is acclaimed and then I get the full credit and you've done all the work minus the kill shot and then I come in and snipe it. Otherwise it backfires and you just help him get more of his own kill shots because otherwise he wouldn't have had the power. And the pieces are large so that some pieces cannot be built unless they are encroaching onto other people's paths. So the game has it baked in. You can't avoid and only go on your own path. So it's a give and take of where to build. So it's got kind of the building aspect to it, where you've built a path and then you resolve the predefined actions. But also with the tower defense, you've got your own motives and then community motives. So that one, I'm calling it Lawn Patrol with the paw as the pun. So that would be a first non-nautical game, should I get that one finished and kickstart that one. So would that be a next year's Kickstarter? We'll see.
Yeah. No, it sounds interesting. I would definitely try that out. And so then I guess for my final question of the podcast, unrelated to what we've already talked about, if you could have been the designer magically of any other game that you didn't make, which game do you wish it was?
I have met Peter Hayward, a very notable and smart designer. He made the game with the beets, which is Village Pillage, and I just loved how simple, it's a rock, paper, scissor, effectively. One thing takes on one thing, and one thing takes on one thing, and then the third thing takes on the first thing. So there's guard, attack, and defense, and I just love how elegant and simple that is. And then a second one that I was playing, and I'm like, dang, I know the designer as well, but I'm like, dang, this is so smart. A Message from the Stars, that one is just so thinky smart. So much had to go into that one. So, you know, you're decoding an alien message and you're trying to figure out what it says. And I was encaptured in that game for almost 3 hours, and it was at an unpub and it was late at night. So I remember walking away from that thinking, that was so smart, and it made me feel so smart playing it, and it, you know, invoked so many thoughts, and then that was a clever design. So I guess one of those would be my top two right now.
I still haven't played that one. I know Clarence Simpson was the one who designed it. Joe from All Play, he's like obsessed with it, I know. So I'll have to give it a shot at some point.
I don't think it was told to me in private, but there may or may not be a sequel coming out, which it makes it even harder to play if you can manage that. For those that, you know, already have mastered the base game. So, you know, people like Clarence, because he designed it, he can get through it with certain efficiency and clarity, but even the next one will be even hard for him to get through.
They had to make something that even the designer can't win. Yep. I'm not great at winning my own games, personally, so I can't relate to that, but love it. Well, thank you so much to everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 122, License to Krill. Matthew, thanks for being on the show. For anyone trying to find you or your company, where can you be reached online?
Thanks so much, Danielle, for having me. My company is Maka Games, so the website is maka.games. There's no www. So maka.games is the web address.
Sweet. And I've been your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find my personal social media, I'm on Instagram and Blue Sky under Token Gamer, GAYMER for the spelling. And then if you're looking for some fun short form videos on our game designing and also just like unboxing some fun designs, check out our new social medias on TikTok and Instagram under Game Design Unboxed, as well as our website. So if that's still new, please check it out and follow us. Thanks. This was great.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at LetsAllPlay.com. Join us next time.